There we go.
Good morning, everyone. It is Monday, September 15th, and I would like to call to order the House Committee on Higher Ed and Workforce Development. The order of agenda is as printed. We're going to touch on the Rooney Rule, tuition waivers for foster youth, accelerated learning, common course numbering, ETIC, and workforce development. These are mostly issues that we have been moving along each session, and we're going to continue to do that. We are looking for updates on some of those from the invited speakers. So I would like to now open an informational hearing on the Rooney Rule, and we have Mr. Sachs, Meg Reeves, Ryan Hageman, and Ben Cannon. Let's have just Mr. Sachs up first, and then followed by Meg Reeves and Ryan Hageman. That's right. Thank you for the reminder. I'm a little bit rusty here. Representative Greenlick, I believe you want to tee things off here.
I didn't see any rust. Yes, thank you. I just want to make a very brief comment. The Rooney Rule was something that I helped pass a few years ago, and the basic notion, the rule is that when the Oregon public universities hire a head athletic coach or an athletic director, that as a part of the hiring process, they interview at least one qualified minority. This has gone, I think, in some ways very well and has done some very good things. We've heard in past hearings on it, in some ways not so good. So there was a proposal, there was a suggestion that Mr. Sachs and I both talked about the possibility of putting some sanctions in the process and including some oversight. So what this very brief hearing today is just to review how things have gone. We've asked OUS to talk to it. We've asked somebody who can talk about the relationship between it and other anti-discrimination activities in the universities. And I've also suggested that perhaps Mr. Cannon could chat with us a bit over the possibility, if we did craft a bill to have some sanctions, would the Higher Education Coordinating Council be the logical place to lodge that oversight responsibility? So that just gives you a little background, and I appreciate you scheduling this here in this very brief hearing today.
Sure. Thank you. And thanks again for mentioning very brief. We have six topics. We have just under 2 hours, so we're going to stick to just under 20 minutes per topic here, okay? So take it away, sir.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Harker, member of the committees. I will make my comments brief. I just want to touch on what Representative Greenlick.
Introduce yourself.
Oh, my name is Sam Sachs.
There we go.
The No Hate Zone. I want to touch on what Representative Greenlick said. When we first brought this bill to the legislature, the goal or the mission was never to punish schools. It was basically to get schools to think outside the box, and it was based on a hiring report card that's been out for probably a decade at least, on how few minorities there are in head coaching positions, athletic director positions across the country. Oregon became the first and only state in the country that has this law. It's a landmark law, and it does require that one qualified minority candidate is interviewed for any head coaching or athletic director position that comes open in the state of Oregon. The bill's been in place for 4 years now, and I would say that there have been some, if you look at it in sports lingo, there have been some wins, some losses, and some ties. The wins have been that you've seen, I think, Oregon has hired a black head coach for their track team. Nigel Burton was hired. He wasn't under the law, but he became the head coach at Portland State University. Black coach, Big Sky black coach for football. There have been some losses. A couple of schools, Oregon State and Western Oregon, have violated the law. And there's been some ties where some schools have just kind of done what the spirit or the letter of the law suggests. I think in tracking and following this law since it's came into place, that some schools could use the assistance of an oversight committee or oversight body to report what they're doing and how they're doing. What have they done differently to comply with their requirement, either their affirmative action law, affirmative action office, and or their school. So I came to Representative Greenlick and to this committee to ask for a possible sanction if schools do violate the law. I'm not sure what that would be. A reporting and monitoring system so that schools would have to, and I think at this point there should be a review. Whatever we do, there should be a review over the last 4 years of how the schools have complied and what they've done that works and what maybe doesn't work, so everybody can get on the page and same page, and maybe we can help the rest of the country. I'd also like to see the minimization of affirmative action waivers, and what those are is that schools, athletic department can ask the affirmative action office for a speedy waiver. It means that they can just go around or circumvent the affirmative action policies. I think Oregon actually has a standing affirmative action waiver. I'd like to see those minimized. And that's really, you know, the reason I'm here today is just to ask that. I think I don't have any power to ask the schools to do a better job. I think they're doing the best that they can, but I think they need some help. I think some aren't doing enough. So I wanted to come here and ask that for your assistance for the schools to try to do a better job and track what is happening. And I think in the next few years, if you look at the turnover at athletic director and head coaching positions, it happens quite a bit. Athletic director at Portland State University just stepped down, so we're going to have another hire there. And I think this could be a good thing for the state and for all schools. I'll take any questions.
Questions, comments? I am particularly intrigued by the standing waiver that I think you said University of Oregon has?
Yes.
Okay. No other schools have a standing waiver that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of, but, you know, it's been difficult for me to get a lot of information from the schools when I've, when I've called and talked to, they know who I am when I call, so they don't always give me information. But the University of Oregon, Penny Daugherty has actually been very transparent and open and told me that they do have a standing waiver. And the waiver is supposed to be really for worst case scenario. You got to really speed the process up to get a coach in. But I think what's happened is a lot of schools have just, they keep submitting, you know, we need a waiver for this every hire so that they can speed up the process and, in my opinion, select the coach that they want to select.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Thank you
very much. Let's hear from some of the other folks listed here. Ms. Reeves and Mr. Hageman, if you will introduce yourselves, and whichever one wants to go first, please do.
Good morning, Chair Harker, members of the committee. I'm Meg Reeves, and I'm the general counsel at Oregon State University, here to address, we were asked to address some specific questions by the committee, and so I thought I'd just launch into that and keep it brief and then take any additional questions that you might have.
Good.
So the first question was, what has your school done to guarantee compliance with the statute in terms of things like recruiting, job announcements, accommodations for interviews, et cetera? And I think our efforts toward compliance have focused on three areas. The first is greater awareness among all of the people who are involved in hiring head coaches at the university. We had a situation that we've disclosed to the committee in the past that I'll talk about more in more detail later in a few minutes, but we did waive in a head coach, a woman, to a head coaching position without compliance with this statute, and that raised our awareness of its requirements, and that is no longer happening. We also engage in more active recruitment through the networks that are available to the athletic department. That includes the Black Coaches Association, connections within the NCAA, the National Sports Women's Sports Administrators Association, and just to name a few. And the last thing we've done is to manage the process to allow for confidentiality for applicants up to the point where they are finalists, which is really critical because assistant coaches are the minority pipeline. And so if they have confidence that they can not get crosswise with their current employer, makes it more possible for them to express interest. Next question was, how many affirmative action waivers have been requested and approved at OSU? Laura Berg was one, has been disclosed in the past. Since then, there have been none. We do waivers for interim coaches because, as a practical matter, coaches often leave with no notice, and somebody needs to manage the program in the interim. We did that with our men's basketball position, which we filled recently. We had an interim for a couple of months. We currently have an interim in the men's rowing position, and we'll fill that at the end of the rowing season, which will be at the end of the spring term. The next question was, what do you find works and doesn't work in complying? We think active outreach works, and not engaging in active outreach does not work. Other than that, the statute works. Have you violated the rule, and if so, why, and what will you do differently next time? As we've disclosed to you in the past, and as has been mentioned already this morning, we violated the rule when we waived Laura Berg into the head softball coaching position. And we did, since then, we do not waive people into head coaching positions. So that's what we're doing differently. When we waived in Laura Berg, we did so under our waiver of search process at OSU. We don't have standing waivers. I'm not familiar with that concept. But our waiver process is administered by our Office of Equity and Inclusion. That's because the point of the process is to allow for uniquely qualified people to move into positions from within OSU and to, in doing so, make sure that our diversity goals are met. In the case of Laura Berg, she was uniquely qualified. She's the most decorated softball athlete in U.S. history. She's won 3 gold medals for the United States. But more importantly, for what we're talking about here, her appointment advanced our diversity goals. At the time, we had 17 head coaches. With her appointment, 3 of them were women. And the data provided to us by the NCAA at that time for Division I head coaching positions, I need to look at my notes for this, was that there were 5,148 head coaches nationwide in Division I. And of those, 1,492 were women. So across 340 Division I schools, that results in an average of 15.14 men and 4.4 women in head coaching positions at each institution. Women are clearly underrepresented in the head coaching ranks, and it's not apparent to us why the statute does not include women as minorities. If you do decide to undertake a review, it would be, I think, worth considering whether the definition of minority in the statute is appropriate. Women is one category. There are many other categories several other categories of underrepresented people that you might want to consider. We were asked, do you think a penalty would be appropriate for schools that fail to follow the law? We don't think it's necessary or appropriate. We follow the law at OSU. And the last question is, has anyone advised OSU against following the law because in their legal opinion it would violate federal law? The answer to that question is no. And that was all I have.
Okay. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you so much for your presentation. And I'd like to ask you to reiterate the points just before the last one. It's always been my position that you really don't need sanctions, that our institutions want to follow the law and the rules. And maybe oversight is a little different question, but the question about sanctions, you, as chief counsel, I mean, is it your position that we follow the law and it doesn't make any difference whether there's a penalty for not following it?
Absolutely. Our advice is always about what the law requires, and a sanction really is immaterial.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I have a question for you in terms of that. So without sanction, is there still a civil remedy for someone who feels that a school did not follow the law? Would that play in?
Chair Harker, Representative Gorsuch, it There could be a private right of action for a person who is an applicant and who believes that the law was not followed in the particular case. I don't think there would be a, maybe Ryan can weigh in on this too. I'm not sure there's a way for a person who's not personally involved to challenge a decision like that, but certainly an applicant would be able to.
So there is a civil remedy.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your efforts to comply with what sounds like the letter and the spirit of the law, because what I would really hate to see is what I had to put up with in broadcasting for years is explaining a waiver in broadcast if your county has 25% minority population of Latino or Native American or whatever, then your workforce has to reflect that percentage. And so do your supervisory positions. You have to have parity all across the board. I found over 22 years, I wasn't always able to meet that. I tried, I advertised in the right places, recruited, but I just couldn't always come up with that. And I would hate to see us move in that kind of direction. I think it's much better to just do your best. And but I would say I would like to see you not just categorically say we're not going to ever do a waiver, because sometimes it might be in the best interest of the students and the team to do a waiver. If you have an opportunity to recruit the wrong color of coach, but that coach could actually encourage a lot of minority students to come to the school because they want to be on that team to work under that coach, it could have a reverse discrimination. So I think there needs to be some common sense in the recruiting process also. And that leads up to a question, and it may not have had enough time to be able to review this, but in the situation where you did do the last waiver for the girls' softball, have you seen any changes in the player participation as far as minorities, plus or minus, or has there been any change?
Representative Harker, Representative Huffman, I can't answer that. I don't know whether that has changed the composition, made a difference in the composition of the player participation. I'm not sure.
It'd be interesting to know.
Yeah, I do. I think it would. I think the way the statute's written right now, it would be a violation of the statute to waive any person into a position, even if that person were a minority within the definition of the statute. So again, if you do open the statute up, that would be something to consider.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I can just point out, all the statute does is require that a minority be interviewed as a part of the process. There's no quotas or anything else.
Right. That's correct.
Okay.
Chair Harker, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Hageman. I am the General Counsel and Vice Chancellor of the Oregon University System. In an effort to keep this brief, I'm here to answer questions. I've appeared many times in front of this committee on this topic and other topics. And so I'm here to represent the four regional and technical universities and just wanted to kind of add a couple of comments. First of all, since the last time I presented in front of this committee, I went back and looked at the data. So since July 1st, 2013, the true universities have hired three head coaches in various sports. All of them complied with ORS 352-380. There is one interim, just like Meg mentioned, an interim soccer coach, and we're just waiting to do the actual search for the head coach for that position. And so since July 1st, 2013, which is the last time I presented actual recruitment data, there have been three vacancies and all have complied with the law. I think one comment I would make in terms of whether or not there should be some sort of sanction or oversight mechanism, I think that might have an impact on this spirit versus letter narrative that we have. And so as much as I love to present to this committee on this topic, I think that we should probably get away from the lawyers doing this and come to the point where we have folks on the ground doing those phone calls to those active outreach areas to increase that pipeline. But I think once you introduce some sort of sanction or oversight mechanism, you're probably going to make it much more letter of the law, make sure the boxes are checked type of narrative. narrative, as opposed to achieving the public policy goal of increasing the diversity of this type of workforce. The final comment I would make, I would echo Meg's comment about women. There's a lot of literature on the underrepresentation of women in collegiate coaching and athletic director ranks, and if this statute were to be opened, that would definitely be something I would look at. Instead of couching this in terms of minorities, go back to the affirmative action experts and start using the narrative of underrepresentation. So I'm here to answer questions. So.
Okay, thanks. Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ryan, could you address the standing waiver concept? We had that brought up earlier. If a university was going to obtain one, who would they go through and for what length of time? But it seems kind of like something we haven't heard referenced before.
Chair Harker, Representative Johnson, the four true institutions don't do this, and I want to be very clear that I now no longer speak for the University of Oregon since Senate Bill 270. But a standing waiver from an HR perspective is something where it would not be associated with compliance with this statute. It would be a situation where, for whatever factual reason, and most logically to me, in the context of athletics, it would be you hire these folks in a week to 10 days, particularly in high profile sports. And so, if the institution itself says we're going to have a standing waiver for certain types of positions, that first of all speeds up the process because of the factual situation, but second of all, really has nothing to do with compliance with this statute. It would be it's an internal process.
Okay, very good. Thank you both. In the interest of time, I'm going to, I don't even have to squelch any further questioning right now. But Mr. Cannon, if you could come up and lend us some insights, that would be great. Briefly, of course.
Very briefly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I think I'm here just to speak to a potential role for the HAC, and I'll just note that for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to be in a position of monitoring the universities and or assessing penalties for noncompliance with this provision would generally be inconsistent with the relationship and jurisdiction and authorities that the commission has today towards the public universities. We are, as you know, a commission responsible for providing budget advice and recommendations to the governor and the legislature, for making funding allocations to our public universities and community colleges, for doing program approval, for doing mission approval for our public universities, and for convening strategies for interinstitutional coordination. So, of course, if the legislature chooses to designate the HAC as the entity that's responsible for monitoring or assessing penalties or other compliance-related activities, of course, we would do that and work with you on that. But it would take us in a different direction than the one I think that the legislature generally intended when we were created in 2011 and then again in 2013.
Thank you. Given the amount of time that you've spent in and around this building, do you have a suggestion of where what entity we might task with that?
Mr. Chair,
if we go down that path, and I'm not at all certain that we will.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I probably want to get back to you on that. I think it may raise sort of larger questions about oversight of state oversight of public universities. And again, if the HEC is where you decide to put that responsibility, we'll work with you. I want to get back in terms of other options.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Jerry, if he's figuring out what the legislature intended in the forming of the HEC, I wish he would testify to that to us. So
all
we
right.
might figure that
Not
out.
Not right now, though.
Okay. Last session.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much.
I never could figure it out.
Okay.
Did you?
I'm looking forward to seeing the notes here and reconsidering. Thank you very much. I am going to, unless there's any other comments, no, I'm going to close the informational hearing on the Rooney Rule. Thank you all who testified. And open an informational hearing on tuition waivers. And is it Susan Dagan? Where? Yes, thank you. Come on up. Since I've already mispronounced your last name, if you would introduce yourself correctly pronouncing it, that would be great. Thank you.
You were
I apologize.
Close. You were close.
Good morning, Chair Harker, Vice Chairs Gallegos and Huffman, and committee members. For the record, my name is Susan Deegan, and I am the Administrator of the State Grants and Government Affairs for the Office of Student Access and Completion. I'm here today to provide an update, a brief update, on the tuition waiver program for former foster youth, which was created by House Bill 3471 in 2011. Just for a little bit of background, OSAC administers nearly 500 privately funded scholarships. We also administer the Oregon Opportunity Grant and a variety of smaller government-funded programs, including the Chafee Program for former foster youth. We are also the home of the Aspire High School Mentoring Program. House Bill 3471 provided tuition waivers, or provides for tuition waivers, to be made to all eligible current and former foster children and foster youth under age 25 who enroll in a public 2 or 4 year public institution for higher education as an undergraduate student within 3 years after the student ages out of foster care or completes high school or an equivalent of a high school degree. It also requires OSAC to prioritize opportunity grants for current and former foster youth in those years when we don't have sufficient state funds to make awards to all eligible students.
It's pretty much every year.
Since 2007, 2008. Yes. We work with the independent living program at the Department of Human Services to kind of help administer this program. They provide us a list of the names of eligible foster youth, and we match those names against the student records in our database to let them know which of their eligible or potentially eligible students have applied for federal financial aid. They have filed the free application for federal financial aid, which is a student aid, which is also called the FAFSA. That is the application for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, as well as for federal Pell Grant and for federal student loans. We provide the names of the students on a secure website for Department of Human Services to check which students have listed which eligible colleges, and then Department of Human Services notifies those colleges of potentially eligible students who were on their campuses. And that is the extent of our participation in that program, is just doing that data match. The Higher Education Coordinating Commission asked us to help them compile data on the number of foster youth who have received tuition waivers in the 2 years that the program has existed. That's a little bit difficult for the HEC, also for DHS to do, because the bill originally as written did not really provide any entity with oversight of the program. So each group kind of does their piece, but there's no one source for all of that data. So I reached out to 24 individual colleges and universities to collect the information for this report. Ultimately, we know that there are a total of 84 former foster youth who received a tuition waiver. The total amount of the tuition waivers for the 13-14 academic year was $110,937. 18 foster youth at community colleges, 66 foster youth at public universities. The numbers may seem a little bit low, but you have to remember also that for foster youth, most of them are very high need students, so they receive in most cases a full Pell Grant and a full Opportunity Grant, and those two amounts combined cover the lion's share or cover the majority of their tuition and fees. The few exceptions are, I think, at the University of Oregon and at Oregon State at this point. So the students at community colleges, for example, who receive tuition waivers are those who are taking classes summer term when opportunity grant funds are not available, or Pell Grants funds may have already been used. There are more foster youth who are enrolled in colleges in Oregon, but 84 total have received those tuition waivers at this point. As cost of education increases, we may see more of those tuition waivers or more students receiving tuition waivers in the future. So I wanted to give you, when I collected this information, I also received some comments from some of the financial aid directors at the different colleges, and you have that list in my testimony, but in my written testimony, but I just wanted to highlight a couple of them. And again, they noted that in most cases, the Opportunity Grant and the Pell Grant cover the cost of tuition and fees in most cases. Some students are eligible, but they didn't file a FAFSA, so the tuition and fee waivers might not have been might not have happened, or we might not have known that they were even out there if they don't identify themselves. One of the issues with some students is that they don't complete the community service requirement. The students are required to complete 30 hours of community service in order to renew that tuition waiver for the coming academic year. And a couple of schools did tell us that they had three or four returning students who had not completed their community service, so were not going to be eligible for the tuition waiver for 14-15. A couple of schools also commented that there is a bit of an administrative burden because there are a lot of expectations about tuition waivers that might be received for students. However, since funds are primarily for tuition and fees, students' primary costs are covered. So there's a lot of monitoring of students who are either not eligible or who have received their costs are fully covered by federal and state need grants.
Could I interrupt you just for a
Certainly.
Moment and back up just slightly to the point where you were talking about the community service obligations or requirements and the failure of some of the folks to meet those, and thus they were not qualified for the next year's funding. Do you have any information about how that played out? Were those people aware that they had to have fulfill the community service and had not done so? Were they expecting to come into the next year's enrollment and have this money available to them, and quite surprised to find it wasn't?
Chair Harker, I honestly don't know. I will check with the schools who commented on that and get that information.
Okay,
for
thank you.
Yeah. Finally, there's the one comment that a couple of schools made is that most of the waivers, particularly the community college waivers, but most of the waivers were done for summer term, which is when opportunity grants are not available, and in most cases, students have already used up their Pell Grants for the academic year. So I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that any of you may have.
I have vice chairs left and right asking. Let's start with Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very interested in a follow-up on your question, getting more information. And additionally, back to my 2013 question on advising all the time.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know how foster children are advised. Are their caseworkers aware of the program? Are the children told about the opportunities? What does the outreach look like?
What can you tell us about that?
Chair Harker, Vice Chair Huffman. I honestly don't know. Like I said, because we don't have one entity who has the oversight, I can find that answer out for you. I can check with the ILP workers, who I suspect do some of the advising, and also the individual campuses do advising. So I will follow up with that question as well.
Great. Thanks.
Gallegos. Thank you for the report. My question has to do with Do we have any data with regard to outcome? What's the success rate? And then in particular, in terms of the ethnic breakdown, since we know there's disparity in the foster care system already, racial disparity, I mean, so that kind of information I think would be very helpful.
Chair Harker, Vice Chair Gallegos, we do not have, at this moment, we do not have a breakdown, a race-ethnicity breakdown. I will check with the ILP workers to see if we can get that information for you. And as far as outcomes are concerned, this program has only been in existence since 12-13. So there have only been two academic years' worth of data, and so there haven't been that many students who have been able to participate. We will work with DHS and provide that information. I don't know if there are any of those students who have completed at this point, but we will check on that as well.
Great. Thanks. Thank you. I know we're asking you a bunch of questions for which you don't have the answers, and that's perfectly understandable. But I do want to say that what you have given to us, at least myself, I find comforting, because this was not, I hoped when we passed it that it would not be just a feel-good measure that we were passing. And clearly we are having some direct impacts on some number of lives already. Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's what I was going to suggest. I think all of my honorable colleagues up here would agree that this is not what we expected to get, and maybe we need to schedule it for the regular session to have some more briefings on this and look at outcomes. So I fully agree with the questions and everything. So
okay.
That would be a strong recommendation to leadership to schedule this for further hearings during the session.
I'll pass that on. Representative Smith-Warner.
And I would just like to highlight the last comment in your written testimony. That clearly was a suggestion from one or maybe more of the community colleges, that money may be better spent on additional advising/mentoring programs or campus-based access and persistence support. Because just, you know, not to make any judgment calls, but I know that that's something this committee has talked about in the past. Representative Gallegos had a bill in the short session regarding that. That is such a huge part of getting these kids to success. Is support, and I've got some friends who work in that kind of in higher ed that way, and that is the critical. It's not just that they're foster kids; it's that they're not coming from a culture of you go to college to succeed. And all of that wraparound stuff is just critical for them to succeed. And so I think that's a really important comment for us to consider as we continue to look at this, that is really a key element of making this a success and guaranteeing those kids' successes.
Clearly, there's a lot of interest in what you're doing with this. And if you would get the answers to those questions to Victoria, she'll pass them out to all of us. And folks, committee members, why don't you... fire additional questions and comments to me and Victoria, okay, after we get the answers. Anything else right now? No. Okay, thank you very much. I am going to...
I do have a question.
Okay, I'm Mr. going to pause.
Of Rep. Gilliam. And this is serious. I haven't been on the Human Services Committee for a few biennia, but... Rep. Gilliam, do you remember, it seems like the number of foster children in the system at any given time is somewhere between 9 and 14,000. Is that kind of in the ballpark, do you recall?
I'd defer to Joe. I think that's probably a good number, but I don't know for sure. Is your question related to how few are being helped by this so far?
Yeah, I realize it was a 2013 bill that was passed, but it seems like if we are in that 10,000 static number range and we've helped 80, something
pretty,
we should add
small.
To the list and look into. That's why I go back to the advising part of it. Are they being told
right.
that this opportunity is out there?
It was a 2011 bill, I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So it was okay.
It was a 2011 bill.
Which lends, okay.
Okay, thank you very much. Now I'm going to close the informational hearing on tuition waivers and open an informational hearing on accelerated learning. We have Ms. Roselli here. There you are. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record, as usual, and take it away.
Thank you. So good morning, Representative Harker and Vice Chair Representative Huffman. For the record, my name is Dr. Hilda Rosselli, and I serve as the College and Career Readiness Director with the Oregon Education Investment Board, and as such have had the pleasure of providing support and staffing to the Accelerated Learning Committee that was authorized by Senate Bill 222. So today, what I'll be doing is providing you with an update on where the committee is right now, knowing that by October 1st, you will be receiving a full report that has much more than this that has not yet been finalized with the committee. We have one more meeting in September. So I'm going to move along rapidly here. Just first of all, review what the charge is for the committee, and to note that we have a report due to the legislature October 1st, 2014. We have had wonderful participation by all of the committee members that were appointed to this committee. And if you were to look at an overall progress report, we've met actually seven times. We have one more meeting this month. We've established a goal and parameters. The committee members have studied a lot of research, talked to individuals, brought in experts, consulted with stakeholders, used the equity lens as a means of laying out priorities, developed a draft paper that sort of captured some of the key concepts and recommendations, and then vetted that with a number of individuals. They have been examining the implications of their work and thinking about what does this mean for financial modeling, costs, outcomes, and benefits, and are now in the process of reviewing and refining a draft legislative concept 274. And then, as I mentioned, their last step will be to refine their report, which is due. I thought it would be useful to highlight what the guiding parameters have been that the committee has continued to use, certainly using an equity lens and looking at where we have inequitable access for students by zip code across the state. Also looking at what is termed a student-centric process that sort of represents where we're seeing now a change where when you think in terms of a P20 system, you no longer think of the sector K-12 and the sector post-secondary, but a lot more conscious effort to look at that blended area where we share responsibilities for students. And then lastly, the committee has spent considerable time looking at issues around a sufficient pool of qualified high school instructors or instructors in general. And I will share more about that in a moment. Just for clarity, there have been lots of discussions around terminology of different programs that this applies to. I do want to point out that in terms of advanced placement and international baccalaureate programs, those are also highly valued by the committee members as being a wonderful option for students. There is a distinct difference, though, in terms of how those programs are organized and coordinated. They do not require approval of a curriculum with a post-secondary institution, or the exams are given by an external provider, and even the training for the instructors is handled quite differently. And so we call out that in the paper that will be coming to you all in October, simply to note that the biggest issues for IB and AP are around stable funding for textbooks and costs of running the programs, as well as the exam fees. But many of the other implications that you're going to see here really more specifically deal with some other program options.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Could you comment, go back on that last slide, please? My school district, Redmond High School, uses the fifth year extensively, and there's a lot of kickback on that. Can you comment briefly on that, please?
Yes, I certainly can, Representative Wisnant and members of the committee. There's been a lot of discussion about this. We've talked in length with Deputy Superintendent Rob Saxton. He is very aware of some of the issues. They have corrected one major flaw that was sort of distorting our graduation rates, and we expect expect that that will show actually a bump in high school graduations in the coming year. There is also a lot of discussion around the use of general fund dollars for that. There is a discussion about a potential proposal that would be separate that would deal with that specifically. Nancy Golden, who is the chair of this particular committee, took this very seriously to heart, brought together members of the school district's representatives that were offering fifth-year programs. The governor came to that meeting and addressed the members, and really we are trying to find a solution that supports the goodwill of the districts that are trying to provide that service, but also balance that with the perception that if every school district did this, it would greatly diminish the impact or a coverage of the general fund.
Briefly, Mr. Chair. I just hope that in your work you'll remember what it's the student, it's the student, it's the student, and it's the cost of higher education. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Wisnant. You just mentioned the benefits for students, and there is a more detailed research summary that I provided you that the OEIB board just requested at their last meeting. I thought it was convenient and timely to share that with you. It is an overwhelming level of support, both at national level, regionally, and within the state of Oregon, that the opportunities for students to enroll in college credits, whether it be AP or IB or dual credit, have very dramatic impacts for students around high school graduation, around their matriculation into post-secondary and their GPAs and successful completion. And I also highlighted in that summary the specific studies that have really looked at students that we might call in the opportunity gap, either low income or students of color, even students from rural districts. So you may find that interesting to look at that in more detail. There were a number of lingering issues that the committee really felt had to be addressed during their work this year. And one was that was something I referenced earlier, and that is that there's still inequity across the state. I will preface my remarks here with these data with a note that one of the dilemmas that hampers your ability to really ensure that every student has adequate access is the lack of a collective data system that enables us to analyze the actual opportunities for students. So here is an example. I'm providing you with some wonderful data that is still not conclusive because it doesn't include all of the program options that might fall into this area. Nobody collects that in one place. So right now, our data from using Oregon Department of Education information and an analysis provided by Michelle Hodera from Education Northwest, we found that in 2011-12, we had over 200 high schools that were probably offering fewer than three dual credit courses to students in a given year. We also found that about two dozen high schools had absolutely no students earning any dual credit during that year. So those are the kinds of inequities. We may be off one or two on that, but those are the kinds of inequities that the committee has really been focused on. Secondly, there is a lot of evidence I would point to, tremendous work being done by the Education Commission of the States on the opportunity for students to experience college rigor before they leave high school. If I do not see myself as college going, or perhaps that hasn't been a pattern in my family, I can actually experience that while in high school and actually perhaps see that I can handle the rigor of high school courses. So it's very important that we assure that there is equitable rigor and access across the board. Also, we have discovered really a variety of funding models in how programs are put together. And so that has been a major discussion. We've looked at legislation out of the state of Oregon with some, the state of Ohio, with some proposed floor and ceiling models. We know that there are some wonderful partnerships that exist between community colleges, four-year institutions, and school districts, but we still feel as though legislation could level that, bring it up to par. PAR so that everybody has access. We are in the midst of working through those details now. In addition, there was testimony provided by a number of individuals around the importance of aligning what the expectations of college rigor are with the new Common Core state standards. We think that's all part of this work. And we really want to make sure that transferability is prime. There's a tricky part of this. For example, if you say, well, it's only courses for the Oregon transfer module that should be offered, then you may limit some students that are pursuing some other courses that would be appropriate if they were moving towards a career technical endorsement or certificate. So we're looking at language that would be open to both of that. And then most important, we have really talked at length about the importance of surrounding students with the kinds of advising and supports that are necessary for success. You could make all the courses in the world available. Students might not still take them if they were not accompanied by some structures that get them helping to look at that, consider the benefits, giving information to parents in multiple languages. And so you'll see in a moment there are some recommendations related to that. I'm not going to go into great detail on all of these recommendations. You have those in your handout, but I thought perhaps it might be useful to make sure that if you had any specific questions that you could stop me along the way. I do want to point out that on program development, recently the Accelerated Learning Committee provided a document and testimony to the OEIB Outcomes and Investments Subcommittee and particularly called out several opportunities for what they called one-time transformational funds that might be necessary. I'm going to start with the third one. Those schools that I just mentioned to you, if there's not a partnership in place, there may need to be some strategic funding that helps start those partnerships up. We also spent considerable time talking about the fact that if there are opportunities for students to fill seats that are still open in classes, we may need to spend some time looking at that more in depth. In terms of financial provisions, there was a very overwhelming support from the committee members, and I certainly am hoping that Representative Huffman's going to add in the flavor of the conversations here, as he has been at all of our meetings. But the idea of charging students for at least the for everything that might be involved with this would be an unfair advantage. And so the committee has used sort of a three courses or 9 credit hours to talk about a baseline in which students would have no costs. There's been discussions about whether or not students contributing some level of cost engages them more, but at least this has been the baseline that the committee has established, that every student should have access to at least 3 courses that are transferable and not have any costs incurred for that. In terms of the costs for running these programs, I think we've really benefited from having testimony and opportunities to engage with both community colleges and four-year institutions and K-12 school districts to really talk about what are the additional costs. It isn't just about offering up a course and making sure there's an instructor. There's an ongoing professional development. There's an ongoing engagement around making sure that the rigor of the course is there, collecting evaluation data, and supporting the instructors in that work. Probably the best model that we've seen doing that right now is Eastern Promise, which is bringing together about 45 representatives from about 45 high schools, 2 community colleges, and a four-year institution for ongoing professional learning communities. In terms of the floor and ceiling that I referenced earlier, there is still some debate about what is an appropriate level and whether or not that should be stipulated in the legislative concept. There has even been discussion about bonus funding or incentive funding. even to the point of one proposal that was raised with the committee didn't go anywhere, but we said, you know, it would be really neat if students who earned these credits could actually also receive an incentive that was held for them in the as an OOG funding that they could then, you know, if I complete a certain number of courses, I might earn money that's held for me once I move on to post-secondary. That one didn't have as much interest from the committee members, but there was discussion about whether or not performance funding models that the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission is looking at might include some incentives here, or even incentives for fifth-year programs as a means of reaching students in the opportunity gap. One other important area, and then I should be able to finish up here, was this whole area around instructor qualifications. We've had conversations with the president of the Northwest Commission on Schools and Universities. We've talked to folks in the two other regional areas that accredit colleges and universities, because frankly, we feel as though this is an opportunity for the accrediting agencies to really rethink what typically some might describe as an input model, that you look at the degrees of the people as the primary means of establishing instructor qualifications, rather than a complementary array of areas. And I'll give you an example that has been brought to our attention. We can have immensely talented high school teachers who are able to teach international baccalaureate trigonometry courses, and their students may be scoring a 5 on those tests. But if they happen to be interesting by virtue of Measure 5, if they happen to have earned a Master's of Arts in Teaching rather than earning a Master's in Mathematics, they may not be quite viewed as eligible for a position in a community college. And so there's lots of discussion here. I am getting ready to, now that faculty are returning to campuses, we will be convening a smaller group of the American Federation of Teachers and Oregon Education Association faculty leadership, the union leadership at community colleges, to have further discussion around this, because we've talked about whether or not maybe there could be an equivalency chart that says, yes, the gold standard might be a master's in the content area, but are there some other equivalencies that could also be factored into considerations for those instructor qualifications. And we did include a potential strategic investment in this area around perhaps offering online coursework during the summer when high school teachers are more willing and able to take courses that would involve across the board. You could look ahead and see, okay, in the next 2 summers, I can take content classes in mathematics in order to establish that I have enough graduate courses in that content area to be qualified. That would take some incentive to making sure that that's collaborative across the state and available. Lastly, I close with the intent of the recommendations, and certainly encourage you to look in your mailbox after October 1st. You should have a full report, and I am sure that the committee members will also be keeping you involved as any legislative draft moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Roselli.
Just answer.
Okay. One way to enable people to take advantage of some of the online learning is for them to enroll in some MOOCs, of course, and anything that we could do to encourage that, I think, would be good. Was that your point?
Yeah. Have you looked into those?
Interesting. Some MOOCs are offered without credit provided, so we have to work through that little tweak there.
What does that stand for?
A lot of them are credit, and a lot of them are by Princeton and MIT.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What is
I don't understand why there would be a question about the professor and all that.
Chair Harker and Representative Wisnett, that's an excellent a point, that maybe a compilation of those on a regular basis distributed to high schools to share with teachers could be a helpful piece, so they're not out looking
individual?
For them.
Why can't the individual students sign up and take it and take it?
Oh, they certainly can do that, but it just meant making the information available, like these are the courses that are available, and keeping that list updated.
a question was asked about what are MOOCs? What is a MOOC? A massive open online course.
Right.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep Wisnett, we're not excluding anything. I, for one, have stressed that we want to make sure that online is available for this, because one of the largest questions and struggles we've dealt with is the instructor certification qualification part of it. And so that very well could play a role. But we do want to make sure that whatever, and this, I think this was the last meeting that we had, we want to make sure that whatever the student does for credit, they actually get credit for it, and it's transferable to a degree. We don't want this just to be busy work or anything like that.
Definitely not.
So if I may just add one point, Chair Harker, to Representative Huffman's comments there, because we didn't talk enough about that today, and that is that there's also this opportunity for courses for students. So you have courses for instructors and courses for the K-12 or the high school students.
Representative Gorsuch.
Going back to the question of whether you had your degree in the proper content area, at our college, and I imagine this is probably standard across community colleges, frequently you need to have a master's unless you have really specific long-term knowledge in a discipline. But you can also gain the ability to teach other things by having those 24 graduate credit hours. And so that would seem to me to be a nice model to also use for K through 12, who might then want to be able to teach something more advanced. It would certainly be in keeping with what we do.
Certainly. Thank you very much, Representative Gorsuch, for that.
And lastly, I think, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hilda, so regarding dual accreditation at the K-12 level and incentives, has the OEIB or is the OEIB considering making specific recommendations to either ODE or to the governor's staff as they put together his recommended budget for some sort of strategic initiative for next session?
As you probably are aware, Representative Harker, Representative Johnson, members of the committee, the Oregon Education Investment Board is still in the process of refining a list of recommendations to Governor Kitzhaber, and at this point there is a placeholder for accelerated learning, yes.
Regarding ODE, though, in terms of funding formula modifications, that would be a little different track. Has that been approached, or has that been, that conversation happened?
Representative Johnson, that certainly is a piece of this work.
Okay, thank you.
Questions? Dr. Roselli, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close this session. And looks like we'll open a informational hearing on common course numbering. Is it Donna Llewellyn and Ben Cannon?
Good morning again. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I'm just going to kick this off and then turn it over to one of our policy specialists, Donna Llewellyn, to speak in a little more detail to the work that's transpired since the legislature passed House Bill 2979 related to common course numbering. One of the HEC's clear responsibilities under statute is to provide for and lead the institutions in strategies for interinstitutional coordination, in part to create clearer and better pathways for students. And I'll just note the importance of this in an era when more and more students, as you're well aware, are experiencing higher education through multiple institutions. One fact that just really jumped out at me when I looked at the number of resident students who received bachelor's degrees from Oregon Public Universities this year, more than half began at a non-OUS school. So just a reflection of the extent to which transfer is a part of our system. And I think it speaks to, or it is a, in some ways, a, it, your actions related to common course numbering, the work that we've done since that bill was passed on the topic is a reflection of that and related facts. I'll turn it over to Donna to speak to it and then see if there are any questions.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Donna Welling, and I'm the Academic and Student Affairs Policy Specialist for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. This morning, you were provided a handout that gives just a very high-level overview of the testimony that I'll provide this morning. House Bill 2979 was passed in 2013, directed the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to convene a work group to examine and recommend strategies to facilitate student transfers between public colleges and universities in Oregon. The work group was appointed by the Coordinating Commission in August of last year, and the first meeting of the work group was held in September. The work group members included representation from the Oregon University System, the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, the Oregon Community College President's Council, and also staff from the HEC, or representation from the Higher Education Coordinating Commission itself. Between September and November, the work group met jointly with the Joint Boards Articulation Commission to discuss the goals of the legislation, possible content of the report, and to discuss recommendations that should be included within the report. Research interviews were conducted in the fall with multiple states regarding their systems of common course numbering. States included Utah, Florida, Texas, Arizona, Montana, and Ohio. The work group finalized their work on November 1st, and the HEC accepted and approved the report for distribution to the legislature. As many of you know, House Bill 2979 is not the first bill in Oregon to direct colleges and universities to implement strategies to improve transfer and student success. Each bill was developed during a unique time and place in Oregon's post-secondary education. And while the Common Course numbering conversation has shifted over the years, statewide collaborative efforts surrounding the Associate of Arts Oregon Transfer, also known as the AAOT, Associate of Science Oregon Transfer, the ASOT, Oregon Transfer Module, Core course equivalency, and others have continued in order to ensure transferability of credits for students navigating public post-secondary institution. Faculty and staff feedback to these multiple efforts over the past several years began with the alignment of content and have recently shifted to the alignment of learning outcomes and course equivalencies. The report on Common Course numbering reflects the need for continued work in the area of aligned outcomes and course equivalencies, and this need is reflected in the report as Common Course numbering equivalencies and outcomes. It's important to note that while minimal or no funding has been included for any of the above conversations or resulting work, progress was made in each area and recommendations for future steps and investments were made. While collaborative efforts continue in many areas, financial investments are needed to implement recommendations and to address many of the barriers that have been identified. The work group recommendations take this need into account. The recommendations from the work group are as follows. Establish annual cross-sector faculty convenings by academic discipline, beginning in the area of general education. State-level full-time staff must be responsible for convening the academic areas and coordinating cross-sector academic alignment. There needs to be a budget to provide for these cross-sector convenings. Institutions have difficulties in participating in these. Provide adequate accountability and resources to build, modify, or enhance a technology solution. And while funding amounts were not identified, the work group recognized the need to provide options for funding, as such, developed a menu of options that range from little or no investment to a larger investment for embedded Common Course numbering equivalencies and outcomes statewide. In addition, the work group recognized that post-secondary education institutions in Oregon did not need new statutes or directives to help them overcome the barriers to student success as identified by the work group. In alignment with the work group's recommendation to convene academic areas and to coordinate cross-sector academic alignment, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission will be sponsoring a second of two faculty convenings designed to ensure that Oregon students master mathematics that is relevant for their future study of work. In order to build on expertise already in the state, The proposal developed by the Joint Boards Articulation Commission brings forward instructors in mathematics and related disciplines to clarify the desired learning outcomes and pedagogy in the area of mathematics for students preparing for a variety of careers. Work is currently underway to bring forward the first group in February 2015. This initial cross-disciplinary convening will be for math instructors and their counterparts in what are being called consumer disciplines. The product of this discussion is intended to be a detailed report of the kind of math needed in each STEM field, together with pedagogical suggestions if appropriate. The second convening, in which the HEC will sponsor, will be held in fall 2015. The second cross-disciplinary math-focused convening will include faculty from economics, business, engineering, other social sciences, and humanities, and will identify the math backgrounds needed by students in these interest areas. The information gathered from these conversations will then assist the alignment of the math course learning outcomes and equivalencies. As the HEC adds staff, we will be looking forward to continuing our ongoing support of these efforts. I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions or comments here? Rep. Johnson,
maybe some comments and or questions, but I did pick up on your reference, Donna, to the lack of a need for further legislative prodding. I guess that's kind of a I get it. But the point remains, I think we're looking for results. You know, and you listed some states at the beginning of your report that have gotten there. They've accomplished it. So I guess from my perspective, as one of those guys who was involved in the original bill, was we're ready for this to happen as soon as possible, because as we talk about, we've got a lot of students who are transferring, and that will likely continue to even grow as we go further. So we need to make sure that as they transfer, that the course numbering system enhances that and facilitates that, and it works to the students' best interest. So I guess I just had something to say and not a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, Representative Johnson, I agree. For instance, Utah has annual convenings or major meetings of faculty across institutions and sectors, which is one of the things that we're working on. This first February meeting is going to be building on what we learned from Utah. In addition, Arizona focuses mainly on course equivalencies and less on course numbering. So we're really trying to learn from those who are out in front of us, who have had some successes, and trying to learn from their journey so that we can start to make progress.
Sounds wise. Any other questions, comments? And is there anything you wish to add at this point, or
Mr. Chair?
Even if there is, you can't. Representative Greenlee.
I'm not sure I understand the comment on course equivalencies and numbering. I mean, if the courses are equivalent, why shouldn't they have the same number? What's the problem?
Representative Greenlick, Chair Harker, let me take a stab at this. I didn't sit in the work group discussions as Donna did, but I think I have a sense. What a student probably cares about most is that the credits they take at one institution are aligned with and transferable to the program of study that they pursue at their subsequent institution. And what the work group representatives, mostly institutional representatives, faculty, et cetera, point out is that what ensures the transferability of credit is the learning outcome that's associated with that course. It's not a number per se, but what a student learns, knows, is able to do as a result of the course.
Yeah, but once you've decided, if I'm taking Sociology 201 at Clackamas Community College, and you decided that's equivalent to a sociology course at Oregon State University, why shouldn't they have the same number? What's the problem?
Representative Greenlee, Chair Harker, I think that's what the work group indicated was that in order to, if one wants eventually to get to a common course numbering system, common course equivalencies or learning outcome equivalencies are the place to start. Now that secondary,
I agree with that.
And we are likely to advance the cause of Common Core numbering through the development of common learning outcomes. We are likely also to hear about, and this isn't to say accept, but hear about some of the logistical, technical difficulties associated with actually making then the course numbering conversions at that point. But clearly where there is faculty in the state and institutional leaders in the state have put a priority around the work of common learning outcomes, which could then lead to common course numbering. I think it's, as much as anything, a sort of cart before the horse, or not putting the cart before the horse. If we want to do common course numbering, let's start with the common learning outcomes.
You okay with that, Representative Greenlee? Transition.
I've taught in the university system for many, many, many years. I understand the most important thing is we do it that way. That's why we do it. And somewhere along the line, it seems to me we need to break down that culture because, yes, you have to start with equivalencies. But once you've got equivalencies, then do something about the numbering system, because it isn't clear to a student that that's going to happen, that they're going to have to go in each time and say to their advisor, well, I took Sociology 201 at Clackamas Community College. What do I have to do? I mean, much easier to say, I took 201, and you have 201, and therefore, check it off. I don't understand what's hanging it up except university culture nonsense.
So, Representative Greenlee, Chair Harker, I think the commission and I share some of that sense of challenge and at times even frustration around these issues. The greatest challenge, however, will not be in the common course numbering. It will be in the equivalencies. Mm-hmm. And that's why mm-hmm. our recommendations and the work group recommendations are to lean into that. Getting faculty to agree on a common set of learning outcomes will make common course numbering look easy. If we were to do common course numbering without the common learning outcomes, we would have done very little for students.
Thank you, sir.
You're very welcome. Representative Huffman. Mm-hmm.
No.
You're pointing my attention down there. Okay, so Representative Gorsuch.
Ben, I have a question for you in terms of this common outcomes. We have a lot of problems between community college and higher ed. To my mind, they're all higher ed, but between those two. One of the things that we've seen in the last few years, and I'm wondering if this will be addressed by this work, is that universities have taken courses that were traditionally 200 level and bumped them to 300 level. And yet the courses that we offer at the 200 level are essentially the same with the same outcomes. Will we get some smoothing out of that, or will that not be addressed by this?
Representative Gorsuch, Chair Harker, it is certainly my hope that as we do this work in discipline-specific ways, as Donna mentioned, the primary emphasis mm-hmm. at the outset is on math, but with convenings of other faculties in other disciplines planned, that we will address those types of questions. They're particularly relevant and important insofar as they touch on transfer degrees for community college students. I think that's where the concern that I noted in my response to Representative Greenlee comes in. And at this point, evidence that I have is anecdotal, but it is evidence that suggests that there's a little bit of fraying around the idea of these common general education courses that constitute an Associates of Arts for Oregon Transfer or the one-year certificate, the Oregon Transfer module. We have some work to do with community colleges and four-year universities to ensure that it is what we say it is to those students.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bisson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, I have my grandson turns 10 next week. When he enters college, will you this problem be solved by then? When is this problem going to be solved? Do we need a deadline on a bill that says you will do it by a certain date?
Representative Harker, Representative Wisnett, you are correct to note that this has been a longstanding challenge. The legislative history on this topic goes back at least 25 years. I might have to double-check my notes to be certain. And it is, I would submit, in significant part because of that legislative history, that Oregon has done a better job than many states of establishing these pathways for students. The fact that the majority of our undergraduate degree recipients at our four-year universities today, the majority began at a non-OUS school, and the largest contributor, of course, is community colleges, suggests, doesn't say for certain, but it suggests that we've done, we, even with the challenges, we're creating some pretty clear transfer options and some, I won't even use the word smooth, but some decent pathways for students. You're right, though, that it has taken legislative attention and interest, and it will continue to take legislative attention and interest. And I certainly hope that by the time your 10-year-old grandson is entering college, we do have this solved. And it is, I believe, a responsibility of the HAC to be working with you on that.
Almost a union money bet.
All right. I think that's an excellent point to get a comment, a final comment from Representative.
I don't want to
Gilly.
Put extra, thank you, Mr. Chair, put extra pressure on you, but he has a very bright grandson who could be ready by 12.
All right. On that note, we'll close the informational hearing on Carmen course numbering. Thank you, both of our presenters, and you're leaving now.
Too bad.
Okay, I will. Sorry. Open an informational hearing on ETIC, which is the Engineering and Technology Industry Council, chaired by Eric Meslow, who is joining us, and is Brian Krieg coming up now as well? Yes. Welcome, gentlemen. Introduce yourselves and
absolutely.
Tell your tale.
Good morning, Chair Harker, members of the committee. My name is Eric Meslow. I am the president and CEO of a company in Tualatin, Oregon, a manufacturing company. I also sit as the chair of ETIC, the Engineering Technology Industry Council, as well as I'm a voting member of the STEM Investment Council, and I also am a board member of the Technology Association of Oregon. I'm going to lead this presentation, and at the end, I'd encourage questions to both Brian and I, as this presentation is going to expand much beyond just ETIC and what we've been up to there, and talk a lot more about the relationships between STEM, STEAM, ETIC, and ultimately CTE. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and get started. The agenda today is really straightforward. I need to leave you with three things. Number one, a major thank you for all the hard work that's been done up to this point to get us into the position of being able to make some major decisions as we move forward. I want to talk a lot about the many efforts in the common ground that is occurring today, and then why the next 12 months, in my opinion, are critical for the state of Oregon in making decisions and moving forward on a very important agenda. First of all, I'd like to start with a simple timeline for the last 6 years. Back in 2009, the CTE committee came together in a task force as generated by, I believe it was the House request for that. They came forward and put together an excellent proposal that ultimately resulted in the CTE Revitalization Grant Program in 2011. About that time, the STEM Task Force was convened. That task force did excellent work in regards to putting together a proposal that ultimately led to the formation of the STEM Investment Council in 2013. Ultimately, along the way, there was a little piece of legislation that formed an organization called the OEIB. And then on top of that, there was a little bit of redesign, I believe, that you guys were involved with in the higher education world and formation of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Ultimately, all of these things have led to a major change and an opportunity for discussion around how things are done. I've been doing this job for about 8 years, and in that time, I've seen things be very rigid, and I've seen things get more open for discussion. And I believe that's where we are today, and none of that would be possible without the great work that you guys have done and many industry and educators have done to get us to this point of having an open dialogue. The last thing that did occur, and we can talk about ETIC if you want to, but that's really not what I'm here to do today. ETIC did go through a relocation and a reformation process in the last short session, House Bill 4020. Thank you very much for you guys' support in that regard. But again, today the real opportunity is to talk about what the state is primed to do. ultimately, this is somewhat of a confusing story. You start off with two individuals, one on the CTE side, one on the STEM side, that have been talking to you and lobbying you in regards to activities over the last few years. But both of these have ultimately silos that we have to work within. Ultimately, the Department of Education, K through 12, we have the community college associations that we used to deal with, and also ultimately the university system for much of what ETIC and other STEM things we're doing. And it causes confusion. And it's ultimately, we have lots of masters that to solve a relatively straightforward problem. You lay on top of that also the fact that we have a great private university system in the state of Oregon that's also contributing to the state's needs. And ultimately, we have a lot of after-school programs that are both focusing on both of these things. You start to have lots of silos. You start to lay in on top of that a STEM Investment Council, Oregon Inc., ETIC, and other CTE revitalization efforts, and ultimately you have something that you can no longer see the original problem around CTE and STEM. This is just a simple analogy, just I'm sure something you guys deal with day to day, and having lots of really good sounding things coming to your desks, but not necessarily understanding what the great overarching picture is. And that's why we came up with, by the way, society's changing, industry's changing rapidly throughout this entire process. Everyone and ultimately, what is involved in being successful in the state of Oregon, having a fulfilling career and being prosperous is also changing. So let's talk about CTE and STEM a little bit. The problems have been dealt with differently. Traditionally, they've been two severely different silos. One is considered this four-year institution, four-year degrees, very simple, straightforward. CTE has been the shop classes. It's been this. That's gone, in my opinion. I think my friend to the right of me also believes that. And it's really about a common set of skills that both of them really have together. And those are simply hands-on, minds-on type of learning experiences that are applied, that engage students, that make students interested in learning with real-world problems, performance-based evaluations, interdisciplinary skills, and ultimately that pull in community partners. These are the two things that both STEM and CTE have dramatically in common. As you can see, the circles don't quite perfectly overlap. There are differences fundamentally at the edges in what we both are doing, but together, we're much stronger than we are separate. And as we move forward into this next legislative session and others, I think you're going to see more discussion between the two groups of doing things together and coordinating to make this less confusing and more impactful. Together, we kind of had a little powwow last week, and we talked about instead going in and talking about STEM and talking about CTE. The buzzword that hopefully you start to hear a little bit more is connecting education to careers, no matter what level that they are at. This convergence of vision, why is this important right now? Again, I've been doing this about 8 years. You have been on this committee or within the legislature oftentimes much longer than that, and you realize that these opportunities don't come along every day. First of all, we have broad industry support in regards to this work at all levels in the trades as well as in technology and healthcare. We have federal support, the president down, the federal legislators are also very interested in this topic, and there are federal initiatives and dollars available. Mom and Dad, frankly, understand STEM and CTE. We've done a good enough job over the last few years marketing this, that they understand the opportunities. I think the notion that a CTE job is just a dirty job, a worker, blue-collar class job, has gone out the window when people start to realize that these are great living wage jobs and are not the jobs of 40 years ago. You also have great support within the OEIB and the OWIB mission alignment. This is, again, something that's transformed over the last 4 to 6 years as legislation has been passed and leadership has changed. This one can't be overlooked. It's about the economy, stupid, I like to say. The fact is we have an economy that's growing, that industry has very specific gaps and needs. We also have a workforce that's aging very rapidly, and so there is a massive difference between what the state is producing and what the state needs for a successful economy. Ultimately, there's some issues that have been recognized through the OEIB and others around equality and equity and prosperity for all regions and all races and all underrepresented groups that are in the forefront that STEM and CTE has a unique opportunity to address. The governor, downward throughout his administration, desires solutions and options from industry and others to bring forward. They're tired of hearing, I think, the complaining or the admiring of the problem. Instead, they're looking for real solutions. And then most importantly, I think we have bipartisan support in the legislature and leadership that is interested in the conversation. Ultimately, the problem is still, what do we do? That is the million-dollar question here. Well, all this leads to an Oregon moment, an opportunity that doesn't come along every year, and we need to take advantage of in this next legislative session. What is that opportunity? Well, to continue the journeyman effort in breaking down the traditional silos of trying to solve these problems. Again, we mentioned before, equity, leaving no talent left on the table, prosperity for all Oregonians. Regional solutions are critical. This is not, as I've dealt with STEM over the years, people think Portland, this is a Portland issue. It's not, it's a statewide issue, and I'd assume the same is for CTE. We need to have a new malleable funding system, look at how we're funding this. One of the critical issues with and flaws around many of the programs is they're granting programs that get great things started, but ultimately there's no money to sustain these things long term and make them part of the culture of the educational system. We need these paths to be flexible for all students in all ages, again, in all regions. And then ultimately, and I really believe that for this to be successful, there needs to be a tighter link between employers and students. I don't care if this is internships or there's committees or direct funding, but ultimately industry needs these things. They need to be engaged and committed in regards to helping to provide them. So, next steps. The real question is, how do we get to a point where there's actually something to vote on or have a good debate over? There's been a tremendous amount of work to this point in getting together a coalition of both companies, educators, and hopefully legislators to define what we want to do in the next session. There are numerous legislative concepts that have been proposed, but again, if we're going to work together, there must be some sort of coordination or overarching omnibus or other type of bill that brings this to you in a logical way that ultimately can be funded. To do that, we believe the next steps are continuing to meet in high velocity over the next couple weeks, as there are, I assume, some looming deadlines in regards to getting this into the legislative agenda as well as the governor's budget. And we're going to need assistance from many of you to be able to do so, so we don't run into any corners, box canyons, or anything else that ultimately lead to nothing being done. With that, I think we're available for questions, and we'll go from there.
Okay, and Vice Chair Huffman would like to begin the questioning.
Thank you, Mr. Comments. Chair. Could we have Mark Lewis come up also? I've got a question regarding the overlap for Mark and Brian both from the CTE and STEM perspective. Just your both of your perceptions about the cooperation and overlap. Thanks, how's it going?
Sounds like a good idea.
Chair Harker, Representative Huffman, members of the committee. For the record, Brian Krieg. I do serve as the co-chair of the CTE grant program and, of course, represent construction and labor interests in the construction community. Here really on behalf of quite a few industry groups today, representing the CTE component. You know, in 2012 and 13, you've done so far 40 grants have come from the program that you guys started just a couple years ago. $12.5 million were put out there. More has gone out for STEM grants. You're already getting people asking me, well, what are the results? Well, okay, they barely have the class going. But there has been a huge result. And what that is, you have ignited serious conversations in every corner of this state between business folks, labor, education community about what are we doing and how can we do it better about connecting careers and education. It has been a very busy 6 months. There have been numerous groups forming, some of them around issues, some of them around the big issues, some around specific small issues that are out there. What I have to say is, in attending many of these, and some of my other colleagues attending them as we talk, similar themes, goals, and issues keep cropping up at every one of these groupings. And it doesn't matter whether it's out in eastern Oregon or whether it's in the Willamette Valley. The barriers are all similar. They're being identified. Solutions that are being come up with are all very similar. The CTE and STEM overlap is, and a continuum of jobs is one of the key things that everybody notes. It really doesn't stop with shop classes just being a siloed item also, or does any of the higher edge. And as many people have gone out and toured some of the labor training centers see, we're talking about physics and chemistry and other things out there and mathematics and science. So getting this, the education community knitted back in with the goals and needs for business out there so that we can have folks getting good jobs, paying taxes, and the state moving forward is absolutely critical. These convergence of factors that you've seen, even right down to the Fed's another set of laws been proposed to give monies to middle schools to get them out and seeing jobs in the field. Those types of things are happening out there. We need to seize this moment with all this energy and interest out there.
Okay. Mark?
Representative Harker, Representative Huffman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Lewis. I'm the director of STEM, CTE, and regional initiatives for the OEIB and for the chief education officer. Since coming on board and joining the office of the chief education officer a year ago, one of the first things on my task was to follow the will of this committee and the legislature to help establish and support the formation of the STEM Investment Council. During those conversations this last year, we have looked at the entire continuum from birth through to career, and it's become abundantly clear to us that there's tremendous opportunities and overlap between the STEM and the CTE worlds. We're looking at a rapidly changing job market and economy that requires transferable skills that are not tied always directly to the types of degrees that we're producing or certificates in our post-secondary institutions. We're talking about skill sets that involve critical thinking, creativity, curiosity, problem solving, the ability to communicate, things that really enable people to respond to that those labor needs. We're also seeing that in the strategic initiatives that have gone out in this current biennium, whether those were CTE revitalization grants or whether those were the STEM investments that were put out for the STEM hubs, the STEM schools, and the STEM STEAM CTE activities. Generally, a tight overlap between the CTE and the STEM worlds. We recognize that at its core, we need to tightly couple economic, workforce, community, and education in order to achieve the prosperity that we need. And that is at the heart of these conversations that we're having.
Okay, thank you. I hope that we seize this opportunity. I won't be here next time, but you all will, and I think that you folks out there see the commitment of the members of this committee as well as others in the legislative body that's been referred to, and we need to keep this ball moving. So during the little bit of time that I'll be here, I will try to make that happen and strongly encourage all of you folks to make that happen and my colleagues up here. Vice Chair Gallegos and then Rep. Johnson.
Yeah, thank you very much for opening this discussion today. Very exciting. I do wonder how, you know, you have the issue about including voices, and certainly the trades are either electricians or plumbers or whatever, as you said, the math and the science that's going into those trades is quite different than it was when when I was working in those fields. I guess how are you doing that, and what do you anticipate happening in terms of any? Do you see any barriers to that kind of thing? I guess is what I'm getting at. And again, I probably a question for Director Cannon is how the heck would be involved in sort of participating in those discussions.
Chair Harker, Representative Gallegos, you do hit a key area that is important to be addressing into the future. The trades have become much more complicated. It is not near your father's plumbing situation or HVAC. We need to have more teachers out there. We need to have teachers who have had some experience in the industry being able to be part of that conversation. Well, we know that we have a shortage coming, looming, of CTE teachers that are out there. That's one of the groups. Representative Erden has pulled together a large group to be, you know, looking at those issues on it. We have course equivalency issues out there, that if we're teaching math and science in the shop classes, we need to make sure that those are going to be counted for the kids to be able to move ahead. And we need to be looking at developing through the industries, looking for the standards that were needed and the certification types of programs that are out there. We do need to be coming from an industry standpoint and presenting what our actual needs are out there and working with the education community. But so that is one part of this. And I think for the in the overall for us, it is the sustainable type of funding. We need to get to back to a different type of model than what we have been using so that the schools themselves will know that this is going to continue, and that the teachers will make the investment in it, and that our industries then also can then partnership, go into partnership and know that it's just not going to be something that's going to disappear a couple years later.
Thank you. Rep. Johnson,
thank
then
you,
Rep. Quisnett, then Rep. Gilliam.
Eric, you, in your report, referenced that there is broad industry support, and we get that. But the question is, how do we effectively engage them? Where's the disconnect? Because for me, this conversation is beginning to sound like common course numbering to a certain extent. I've been here for 4 years hearing the same thing. You know, we've got Intel that's really enthusiastic. In my neck of the woods, we've got in situ in our UAV industry. They really want to jump on board. But what is it that either we're not hearing from them or that's wrong with the process of trying to get them involved? What do they need to hear? What does the private sector need to have so that as we put out the first round of CTE grants, we provide a mechanism for the private sector to jump in to make them sustainable? What's missing? And I know that's a big question, but that's where I'm at. I mean, I feel like for whatever reason, the legislature doesn't speak private sector. We don't get it, or somehow we're not understanding what you all, because you're one of them. You are a member of this industry as well. What would it take for you to jump up and really participate in a big way?
Chair Harker, Representative Johnson, I've said this before in front of this committee and others. I tend to speak very frankly, and sometimes there's a wake because of that. But I'll go ahead and speak frankly again in this case. It is my opinion only, that for industry to be engaged in the legislative process and to be engaged in any sort of form of state government decision making, they need to have some level of both skin in the game, as well as some level of assurance that their recommendations are going to be listened to and enacted on. I've sat on many, many councils that created great output and excellent reports that simply hit the round file as soon as they got into whatever state agency they were directed towards. Mm-hmm. So it's been my experience that I've been very pleased to be part of ETIC, primarily because ETIC had some level of control in regards to the budgetary process. Okay. Our recommendations, I don't want to say had to be listened to, because that's not the case. They could still be rounded off and they could still be tweaked. But the main part is that you had some feeling that what you were recommending would eventually see the light of day. Okay. And for me, I think that's the important piece for industry. But the price of doing so for industry should be they need to commit and get skin in the game. And that's not – many industries don't know how to do that. And there's a variety of ways to do that other than just writing a check. And I think small organizations like STEM Hubs and other things are exactly the model to do so to get involved. Ultimately, industry will, in many cases, will only do what they're asked to do. But somebody's got to ask, and I don't hear enough of that coming from the state and from state agencies and schools. Ask, and your chances are much higher to get a yes than not asking at all.
I would hope, Eric, that you would feel that the work that we've done together over the last few years has not led just to reports that wound up in the circular file or the shredder or whatever, and I feel like I'm not going too far out on a limb asking you this, but I would love to hear or to sit down and brainstorm a bit more about how to take those next steps, because as probably all of us up in the front part of the room and many of the others know, when we set up the STEM Investment Council, we were looking for wins. We were hoping to show real earnest effort on the part of the state and concern in moving forward in this direction, and that we're putting in some seed money and trying to create the structure, the infrastructure, to let the industries and other elements in the state really play this game and collaborate with us and our limited but significant resources.
Representative Harker, yes.
Thanks. Let's see, I think, Gene?
Just real quick, thank you, Mr. Chair. Eric, Brian, thanks for all your work. I think everyone up here wants to help you and all the work. It's tough work. Please, when you're working on this issue, and I talked to AGC, they've established an office to be sure you're looking after veterans and taking in effect their credits and their training so we can get them employed through this. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Okay, we need to wrap this up. You got something?
Yeah, I have a quick question for you, Mr. Chair, and our panel. Have you all heard specifically about a program in Washington County with Hillsborough's Chamber, School to Work? It's about health careers and presentations. Is that something you're familiar with? Is that
sorry.
Come across your...
It's not one that I am aware of at this point in time. Anyone over there saying yes?
I hope it's just something I heard about, and I'll just say I hope we can take a look at that.
Yeah.
Here's a note on it, Mr. Chair, in December.
Okay.
I think it relates to what we're talking about, Gilliam, in a really specific way.
I can tell you that there is a significant, when we look at the needs for the state of Oregon, ETIC has been focused on the high-tech community, obviously. There are proposals and legislative concepts moving forward that very specifically broaden that into healthcare and other valuable trades and needs for the state of Oregon. If you look at the metrics, we are in crisis in regards to the healthcare industry, and I would assume that you'll see significant language in that regard.
Good. Thank you. Okay. Very good. Thank you, one and all. Mr. Cannon is on the agenda here, but we are, he and I have spoken, and in the interest of time, we're going to move into the next subject, and feel free to contact him, and he will, of course, feel free to contact us. I am closing the informational hearing on ETIC and opening an informational hearing on workforce development, and here are our presenters. Thanks for coming right up. I apologize, but you were told you had about 20 minutes. I for sure will give you 20 minutes, and I will ask anyone else who is able to do so to please do that, okay?
Chair Harker, Vice Chair Huffman and Gallegos, thank you very much. For the record, I'm Agnes Balassa with the Governor's Workforce Policy Advisor, and I'm here today with...
Commissioner Alan Unger from Deschutes County, and also a member of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, along with Representative Huffman.
And great. We will be quick. We will try to get you through this in the allotted time, or sooner if we can.
All right.
So thank you for the invitation to be here today. It's our understanding that the committee was interested in an update on where we are with a process of looking at the local workforce area boundaries across the state. And so in terms of the presentation, what I will do is briefly describe how and why we got to where we are, and then leave it to Commissioner Unger to share with you from a local perspective how this is working, as well as from the state board's perspective, the Oregon Workforce Investment Boards. The quick background, as you all are aware, is that We're living in a changing economy. We're living in a changing context where we have increasing economic disparity across the state, as some regions have recovered far more rapidly than others at the end of this last recession. Some are actually still facing very recession-like situations. And the truth is that job creation is a local activity. While there are many things the state can do to incent and support job creation, ultimately, it's about having a robust menu of aligned services in communities that support the needs of businesses to grow and to thrive. With skills becoming a competitive advantage in economic development, and the need for us to focus more heavily on skill development, one of the things we've been looking at across the workforce system is how to better align and the various services that are out there to better support a highly skilled workforce, especially as we continue to hear large numbers unemployed, not necessarily the right skill mix to match the needs of businesses and industries. We're also looking at this in a context of decreasing federal funding. All of the federal programs that support workforce development have been in some level of decline over the last 10 to 15 years. And so the need to align is more significant than it's ever been in order for us to be able to focus on local solutions for local problems. And so one of the things I'm going to show you really quickly before I go to that slide. Whoops. This is the current map of Oregon's local workforce investment areas. Under the Federal Workforce Investment Act, the state is divided into local areas that then make decisions about how to invest resources for local needs. And if you look at this, the entire large blue area is one local workforce investment area and has been since, I believe, the 1970s. When we started to talk about what's really needed in communities in order to support job growth, this doesn't feel very local. You're talking about a wide variety of labor markets, everything from coastal to high desert, ranching to fishing to having the Bend-Redmond corridor in the middle of that, the Hood River area in the middle of that. And so as we looked at whether our boundaries lined up with the goals and mission of a workforce system, we asked the question, are local elected officials interested in changing those? And in this case, the local elected officials under the law are county commissioners. They are the ones with the responsibility for making decisions about their boundaries. And so in March of this year, the governor issued a invitation for the locals to consider whether they wanted to change their boundaries. The policy context for this relates to an executive order that was issued by the governor in 2013 to clarify the system-building role that I have just described, and that was codified in 2014 under Senate Bill 1566, which created the framework to better support this kind of work. Under the federal act, each of these local areas also receives what is called a local workforce investment board. And the roles and responsibilities of that local workforce investment board is to lead the alignment of those services and resources to better support the economic development goals of a region. And so that's how it all comes together. First, the locals determine what their boundaries are. Once they determine what their boundaries are, a local workforce investment board is put into place. That board becomes approved and recognized by the governor, and then that board receives resources in order to better align in a community, to better create synergies, to identify local needs, to invest in the needs of local businesses. And so I'm going to skip this one because I've just said that. And so as a result of our invitation, four local areas started to form out of that large blue mass that we showed you. A South Coast region consisting of Douglas, Coos, and Curry, a Central region, which Commissioner Unger will speak to, an Eastern region, and then we still have in process a coastal region. The three northern coast boundaries started conversations with Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln counties. As a result of that, Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln counties have been undergoing a fairly thoughtful conversation about whether they are really one labor shed or not, and have been considering the possibility of joining either with the boards to the north or with Lynn County to the south. So we still have some conversations going on, but that's exactly what we had hoped would result from the invitation, was an opportunity for local areas to take a look at what's changed since these boundaries were put in place in the 70s. What opportunities does that create, and are there alignments that really better match the way businesses and individuals work together? And so That's where we are right now. The State Workforce Board has approved the Eastern Region, the Central Region, and the South Coast Region. We're in the process of meeting with each of those regions to start to help them set up their local workforce investment boards. We'll be starting with the Central Region at the end of this month. And then once those boards are in place and the organizational structures are solidified, they will begin to receive funds July 1st, 2015, in order to implement their responsibilities.
Chair Harker and committee, we're excited locally about this change. You notice that there are still big areas. When you look at the Far East or the center of the state, we're looking at 8 or 10 counties. Well, they need to be that big because of the workforce money that comes from the federal government. You have to have a certain amount, and it comes with population. So basically, in the center corridor, it's probably Deschutes County who's going to carry those other 7 counties with it to form that local workforce board. It's still big. It's still 3 areas. You've got your community college and your economic development up to the north around Wasco and Hood River area. You've got your central area with EDCO, and then you've got your south with Klamath and Lake County with their community college. So what we're thinking of doing is taking in having 3 focuses with 3 mini boards that kind of come together with that mix of business, education, and economic development, so that we can have a local focus to bring forward the needs of our businesses that we need there with our economic, with our employment department, and with our workforce training system. And the legislation you did in the last session helped us bring those two systems under the same role, with the local workforce board as kind of that group that kind of oversees how they work, so we can really have a much greater vibrant worksource centers, one place for people to come. And if you talk to our businesses, most of them are 5 business, have 5 employees or less, they really want that one point of contact. They don't want multiple program deliveries, whether it's the community college, the schools, or whatever else, the employment department, to all come to them to say, here, hire our people, or this is what we got for you. They want the employment department to do that, have that relationship, so that they can then bring them those 5 workers that they have vetted through, that that business could then look at and choose who they wanted. They also want that on-the-job training money, because there's still things that that business needs to do to get them that last mile so that they're really set up and can do the job. So we are also excited about our youth. You know, if you look at who's been left out of this job growth, it's been our youth. We want a cradle to career path for them. We want to use the career technical education program. We want to get into business mentoring. We want some paid summer learning opportunities for them so that they can have certificates and apprenticeships. They can go right from high school, if they want to, into a job situation, because they now know what a job means and how to show up for a job. The CCWD, the Community College and Workforce Development System, is bringing on 4 contractors to help us form these boards, because there's a lot of legalese and a lot of forming and things that we need to do there. And I'm really thankful and urge you to support the budget that will help grow the on-the-job training funds and the youth programs that we can take, and we can really create a vibrant system at home.
Okay. Yes, Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My hope in all of this, because the big blue area was unwieldy, and it was a lot of the local boards just were, I shouldn't say a lot. I know of some local boards that were pretty much non-existent. Mm. With regional solutions being strong, what I see and I'm hoping to continue is that our university folks in these regions, our community college presidents, our local elected officials, the STEM hubs, you know, all of these groups are a lot of the same players in the same rooms, the same meetings. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be talking about these issues and connecting them for the regions. And there's going to be a lot better communication coming out of it, coordinated efforts, so that one group is supporting the regional strategies top 3 to 5 list. So I encourage legislators to be as involved as possible in your regions to make sure that, you know, folks are talking and the system is working as it should be.
Excellent advice. Other comments? Vice Chair Gallegos, you had something?
Yeah, I just Representative Huffman answered my question, but it just related to the previous presentation and sort of that overlap in terms of workforce development of STEM and CTE and how we're going to begin to mesh that discussion. And so perhaps that.
The local workforce board's where to do it.
Yeah. Representative Harker, Chair Harker, Vice Chairs Gallegos and Huffman, I think part of what this does is it puts another set of hands on the ground. And one of the things nobody really gets paid for in the system is coordination. Everybody has to try to figure out how to make it the extra add-on. And yet we know it's exactly what's critically needed in order to move some things together. What this is really intended to do is to not take away the power of any of the local organizations that college boards, et cetera, that provide guidance to their systems, but to better coordinate across all of those functions and see where new synergies can be developed. And so I want to be super clear about that, that the oversight function really is an oversight about the collaborative space, the space together to make things happen, the space to realign when needed, to better understand, and the conversation you just had about translate business needs into programmatic language, because the reality is many of us in the system, public, private, education, et cetera, don't speak the same language as business also. And so trying to figure out how to make that translation happen more effectively and efficiently, I think, is one of the keys that will help us all.
Agreed. Rep. Johnson.
Real quick, my commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Agnes, my frustration is
your second home
manifold, but I'll try to focus on some things. What I'm not seeing in very many areas, not just with what we see here today, but is across the spectrum from business to public education, is alignment. Mm-hmm. We've got regional, the governor has regional solutions teams. Rep. Huffman and I participate in our one that is in the gorge and so forth, where you've got business at the table, you've got the public sector there, you've got education there, talking about how can we regionally collaborate to get to the outcomes. On the education side, we've got regional achievement collaboratives. That's another layer, okay, where, again, you've got some business interest there, but primarily in the public education world. You've got K-12 there. You've got post-secondary there. All, how can we collaborate to provide a better product? Now, on top of that, we're going to lay these new workforce investment areas, and I just don't see any kind of alignment there. And my question would be, wouldn't your mission be better served trying to jump into one of these regional areas that are designed to have common interests and to work towards common outcomes that are for that region, not simply on such a macro level, but it just seems to me that we need more vertical alignment in purpose and intent and personnel that are having the same conversations with the same people rather than of this fragmented and fractured effort. I'm not faulting your effort here, your motives, but I'm just seeing a lot of things going on that aren't aligned.
And Rep. Johnson, I recognize your question is for me, but Al's jumping to answer.
Yeah,
I'll piggyback.
That's
off
great. Chair Harker and Representative Johnson, one of the challenges is like 10 counties. We're really in three regional solutions areas. Mm-hmm. We have, it's bigger than those, but I'm also a regional solutions member with our local team. And so we have some alignment with our regional solutions teams to kind of, they're watching, they're seeing what we're doing, and if there's a challenge, we have not only Agnes to bring the issue to Salem and to the governor, we also have the regional solutions people to help us with that same thing. So we're trying to create more alignment. I think that we're trying to focus more on our business people, and really our regional solutions are convened by local business and try to have that focus there too.
Rep. Johnson and members of the committee, if I may add to that, part of what the workforce board does is it brings what you didn't have in all of those other mixes, the 14 plus federally funded programs that serve over 300,000 unemployed Oregonians every year, trying to bring them into the mix as part of that. And that's a large system that serves a large number of people that needs to have a more customized approach than what we can offer today based on local community needs. Ideally, if this all works, as we hope, ideally, as regional solutions start to identify more and more workforce projects, as I look at the list of what regional solutions has identified for needs, many of those are actually workforce projects. This brings an additional system to the table to help with that answer, an additional set of partners to help with that answer. As your regional education compacts try to solve the question not only of how do people complete their education, but how do they then become employed in today's market, especially when you have a market that's looking for people who already have skills, not just those who are coming up through the education system. How do we build the programs like on-the-job training programs, like supporting registered apprenticeships, like supporting paid internships, all of those additional pieces that make that last link that allows a personal investment in education to actually translate into a placement in a job and starting to earn and pay tax, earn wages and pay taxes and become part of the system. I think those are the pieces that these boards help to bring into the mix in some large state investments like the Employment Department, portions of the Department of Human Services, the Jobs Program, the Vocational Rehabilitation Program, et cetera. So that's part of the hope, is that through these boards we can actually bring the rest of that picture into the mainstream as well in support of your efforts.
All right. Well, we'll stay in touch.
Not a question, Mr. Chair, but just a comment. All that area is, I'm sure the governor's office and the governor knows, is higher unemployment than any other part of Eastern Oregon. We need help. I hope this works. I share Representative Johnson's concern, too, but I'm sure that Commissioner Unger, who has a very successful record, will help solve some of our issues over there. Appreciate him coming down, and be safe traveling home, Commissioner.
Part of why we did this was recognizing those needs and that activity in Central Oregon, and so
Southern Oregon. Klamath and Lake were the highest.
Yeah. Yes. So thank you very much for that point. I want to thank both of you for coming, for the work you're doing, and for presenting to us. I will close the informational hearing on workforce development. We will continue conversations. And thank you, one and all, for being here, especially the presenters, for taking the time to fill us in and bring us up to speed. Just for the record, Vice Chair Huffman asked earlier about the number of foster children that the state has on a daily basis, and Rep. Gilliam has left a note with me saying that, for the record, there are about 8,500 foster children in the state of Oregon on average daily basis. I don't know anything about the breakdown of those kids age-wise, but we'll get more info on that. And while we're making some progress, we all agree more needs to be made.
Not enough.
Pardon?
So that's about 1%.
Yes, of the total population, though, which is, of course, not all of college student age. I am going to adjourn this meeting of the committee. Thank you. Adjourn this meeting of the committee.